trying to contend with such unequal forces, and with a single pocket pistol killed and wounded as many as they. In him was the spirit of dauntless bravery exemplified. Willard Richards, the only man with Joseph to survive the gunfire unharmed, reports that Joseph discharged one barrel of a six-shooter at random in the entry. And John Taylor, who survived the incident with four bullet wounds, relates that when Cyrus Willock visited the imprisoned man, Joseph eagerly accepted the pistol from him. Quote, Brother Joseph immediately replied, Yes, give it to me. Doctrine and Covenant, section 135, comprises the most easily accessible and most widely read account of the events surrounding Joseph Smith's death, written by John Taylor for the purpose of announcing the martyrdom of Joseph Smith the prophet and Hiram Smith the patriarch. This account's failure to mention Joseph's self-defense and the fatal accuracy of his shots explains any surprise one may have upon learning that Joseph died subsequent to a gun battle. Perhaps the picture of the pistol-wielding prophet detracts from Joseph's martyrdom, or at the very least causes confusion, for what kind of martyr does not embrace death? Prior to his return to Carthage, Joseph reportedly echoed Isaiah 53, a passage interpreted in the Book of Mormon as messianic prophecy, saying, I am going like a lamb to the slaughter. But while the metaphorical lamb of Isaiah remains mute before the shearers, the metaphorical lamb Joseph roars like a lion. Hence, the metaphor breaks down, for whoever heard tell of a lamb killing his slaughterers. That Joseph's retaliation poses problems finds witness in the silence it receives in the canonized Doctrine and Covenants account, as well as literature published near the centennial of Joseph's death. William A. Morton's From Plowboy to Prophet, Heber J. Grant's and Joseph Fielding Smith's June 1944 Improvement Era Tributes, and Daryl Chase's Joseph the Prophet entirely overlook Smith's violent actions. Joseph died a martyr to truth, proclaims Grant and Joseph Fielding Smith, while Morton and Chase overtly compare his death to Jesus' crucifixion. Perhaps most telling as to the difficulty that Joseph's resistance offers is that Spencer W. Kimball's 1946 The Pattern of Martyrdom defines a martyr as one who willingly dies and then completely ignores Joseph's lethal actions. Published 3 years after this centennial, Gordon B. Hinckley's Truth Restored, A Short History, used by missionaries throughout the world to orient potential converts to church history, paints Joseph as lamenting his brother's death and then immediately dying himself, thus preserving Joseph's final behavior as exemplifying brotherly love, not filial vengeance. Following the precedent set by the Doctrine and Covenants account, omitting Joseph's marksmanship has become a Mormon tradition. Martin Alder's 1954 play, No Greater Crown, for example, shows Joseph receiving the pistol but never firing it, thereby breaking a cardinal rule of drama. If a firearm presents itself on stage, it must discharge by play's end. LeGrand Baker's 125-year anniversary article, On to Carthage to Die, published in the Improvement Era, fails to mention that Joseph was armed, as does a 1971 Friend article, They Were There. Curiously, Larry Porter, then director of church history at Brigham Young's Religious Studies Center, ambiguously mentions Joseph firing his pistol in the 1984 April I Have a Question Ensign column by citing a contemporary account printed in the Daily National Intelligencer as an example of distorted copy. Completely breaking with the tradition of silence in official popular church magazines regarding Joseph's actions, Reed Blake's Martyrdom at Carthage in the June 1994 Ensign, commemorating the sesquicentennial of Joseph's death, reports that not only was Joseph armed, but so was his brother Hiram. Blake's... It's not on? Okay. Is it now? Okay. Blake's article may mark a shift in church policy, opening the door for grappling with the whole story surrounding Joseph's death instead of exclusively focusing on aspects which fall into the traditional pattern of martyrdom and thereby seemingly testify of Joseph's divine calling. June 27, 1844 reigns in Mormon tradition as a day of supreme sadness, a day when the best blood of the 19th century was spilled, a day that, according to Brigham Young, caused more than five barrels of tears shed. While Section 135 of the Doctrine and Covenants announces the martyrdom of Joseph Smith, the prophet, on the sesquicentennial of his death, I ask this question: was Joseph really a martyr? This is not the first time, however, that the question has been asked. Roberts poses it in his 1911 History of the Church in a footnote, saying, "May Joseph Smith be classed a martyr." Roberts notes that, quote, "Whenever the terms martyr or martyrdom as connected with the name of Joseph Smith are used, they are placed within quotation marks by nearly all non-Mormon writers, and certainly so placed by all anti-Mormon writers. The claim of martyrdom for the prophet is quite generally denied," end quote. Roberts attributes the denial of the title of martyr to an exaggerated idea of what constitutes martyrdom and the fact that Joseph Smith offered resistance to his murderers. This study seeks to reassess Joseph Smith's status as a martyr by examining 150 years of friendly accounts of Joseph's death against the backdrop of the Christian tradition of martyrdom as contained in the Bible, Acts of the Christian Martyrs, John Fox's Book of Martyrs, and the Book of Mormon. I intend to explicate the radical redefinition of martyrdom required to label Joseph Smith a martyr. Pairing of significant details which contradict the pattern of martyrdom will also receive attention as this study endeavors to illuminate the uniquely Mormon appropriation of the Christian ideal. "Martyrdom is the highest point of the spiritual priesthood of holiness," observes Donald Atwater in his book Martyrs. According to Atwater, the first account of Christian martyrdom describes itself in Acts chapter 7 with the death of Stephen. In its simplicity and straightforwardness, that first account of the acts and passions of a martyr provided a prototype or pattern for all such sacred writings, writes Atwater. The pattern established in the account of Stephen consists of five main parts: the arrest, the trial, the martyr's testimony, embrace of death, the martyr's prayer before dying. The biblical account of Stephen's death portrays him loving his murderers and gracefully embracing death for Jesus. As they stoned Stephen, he made no attempt to flee, but, quote, "kneeled down and cried with a loud voice, 'Lord, lay not this sin to their charge.'" In a very real way, Stephen mimics Jesus' passion and final words, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." The descriptions of Jesus and Stephen establish a pattern of non-resistant martyrdom, which has lasted for nearly 2,000 years. In the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus, for example, graciously accepts arrest, forbidding his disciple from fighting. He who lives by the sword dies by the sword. Additionally, he heals the wounded slave's ear, which was cut off by one of his disciples, firmly grounding benevolence towards one's persecutors in the discourse of martyrdom. This benevolence achieves its pinnacle in Jesus' plea for God to forgive the soldiers as they crucify him. Alison Goddard Elliott writes in Roads to Paradise, reading the lives of early saints, that martyrdom literature celebrates community as, quote, "the values depicted are those of an entire society." Thus, the martyr's actions form a symbolic representation, a cross-section of the community's entire belief system. In the case of Jesus and Stephen, their final actions and final words exemplify unbridled love, compassion, and pity for their persecutors. While the final actions and final words of Joseph Smith, "That's right, Brother Taylor, parry them off as well as you can," exemplify a desperate communal desire for self-preservation. While the accounts of Jesus and Stephen solidify a discourse of martyrdom, which later found expression in hagiographic writings such as the Acts of the Christian Martyrs, and in Joseph Smith's time, in John Fox's popular Book of Martyrs, the accounts of Joseph's death raises all sorts of questions. Is vengeance part of martyrdom? Can a martyr kill his killers and still receive the title? And finally, does martyrdom solely signify unjust death? Written at the end of the 16th century, the Book of Martyrs underwent a myriad of reprintings, making it by the early 19th century, quote, "one of the most widely displayed, if not read, volumes on the American frontier." On its title page, the Book of Martyrs proclaims itself to be a history of the lives, sufferings, and triumphant deaths of the primitive as well as the Protestant martyrs. Page after page chronicles the disgusting tortures inflicted upon believers in Jesus and martyrs' resolute willingness to embrace death for his sake. The martyrdom of 13 Christians provides a typical example of the attitude embraced by the people who died for their beliefs. He then led them to the place where they should suffer, and being all there together, most earnestly they prayed unto God. And they joyfully went to the stake and kissed it and embraced it very heartily. The 11 men were tied to 3 stakes, and the 2 women loosed in the midst without any stake. And so they were all burnt in one fire, with such love to each other and constancy in our Savior Christ, that it made all the lookers on to marvel. Similar to the Book of Mormon, Fox records the burning of scriptures and wholesale martyrdom. As the bloody rage of this persecution spared neither man, woman, nor child, wife, nor maid, lame, blind, nor cripple, all went into the fire. Quite commonly, Fox's martyrs receive an opportunity to recant belief in Jesus as the sole provider of salvation. John Rogers, for example, refused, saying, "That which I have preached, I seal with my blood." Interestingly, the phrase, "sealed his mission and his works with his own blood," appears in the Doctrine and Covenants, along with 4 italicized references to Joseph's innocent blood, almost as if repetition of the formula lends credence to the claim. A product of Joseph's endeavors, Abinadi marks the entrance of the trope of martyrdom into Mormon scriptural currency. He follows the pattern established by Stephen with one distinct addition, threat of divine retribution. It's true that John's apocalypse describes the blood of the martyrs as crying to God for vengeance. "How long, O Lord, holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth?" But threatening retribution, even divine retribution, is anathema to the corpus of martyrdom literature. Flogged first, wood then was piled around Abinadi, and when the flames began to scorch him, he cried unto them, saying, "Ye shall be afflicted with all manner of diseases. Ye shall be smitten on every hand. Ye shall be hunted. Ye shall suffer as I suffer the pains of death by fire." Thus, although Abinadi tells his murderers that "I have suffered myself, that I have fallen into your hands," his behavior in the while in the flames contrasts vividly to that of, for example, St. Lawrence, who, while burning, remained calm and collected even to the last moment, exhorting the spectators to embrace the religion of Jesus. As Herbert Musurillo notes, martyrs reply with a loving charity which embraces even those who persecute them. Needless to say, in cathartic fashion, Abinadi's murderer, King Noah, receives his just deserts, suffering even unto death by fire. The account of Abinadi adds the uniquely Mormon aspect of vengeance to martyrdom. Notwithstanding Abinadi's threats, the Book of Mormon contains entirely traditional expressions of the discourse of martyrdom. Women and children who followed Alma and Amulek, for example, offer no resistance when put to death. And they brought their wives and children together, and whosoever believed or had been taught to believe in the word of God, they caused that they should be cast into the fire. And they also brought forth their records, which contained the scriptures, and cast them into the fire, that they might be burned and destroyed. And it came to pass that they took Alma and Amulek and carried them forth to the place of martyrdom, that they might witness the destruction of those who were consumed by fire. While these people accept death, once again, the reader finds nearly immediate cathartic satisfaction as an earthquake kills the villains and frees Alma and Amulek from prison. In this way, the Book of Mormon contributes evidence to the discourse of martyrdom that the persecutors of Christianity receive punishment for their actions. In other words, the Book of Mormon, in a way, answers the plea in Revelations for divine vengeance by illustrating it, usually within a few short chapters. The people of Nephi-Lehi, constitute the third and most traditionally faithful example of martyrdom contained in the Book of Mormon. Upon seeing the approach of their murderers, they prostrate themselves, call on the name of the Lord, and let themselves be killed. And thus, without meeting any resistance, they did slay 1,005 of them, and we know that they are blessed, for they have gone to dwell with their God. The people of Lehi-Nephi gracefully accept death in similar fashion to Lawrence Saunders, who walked with a merry chorus toward the fire and then fell to the ground and prayed. And then he rose up again and took the stake to which he should be chained in his arms and kissed it, saying, "Welcome the cross of Christ, welcome everlasting life." These 3 chronicles of martyrdom found in the Book of Mormon all fall within traditional expressions of the trope in that the martyrs offer no resistance to their murderers, while their pacific actions stand as a testimony of their faith in Jesus. Whether or not one interprets the retribution against the villains in the Book of Mormon as the fantasy fulfillment of the longing for divine vengeance expressed in John's revelation, all of the martyrs conform to the mold of a wholehearted embrace of death, one that serves, as is so often the case in Fox's Book of Martyrs, to convert those who witness their destruction. We need but think of Alma the Younger, right? The Book of Mormon's cataloging of the efficacy and immediacy of God's divine vengeance, however, distinguishes it from traditional discourse on martyrdom. In keeping with the traditional pattern of martyrdom, Martin C. Nalder's 1954 play No Greater Crown portrays Joseph Smith as selflessly and resolutely accepting death. More than a century after his death, Nalder's Joseph explains his motives. "I realized that by dying, I would prove to the world that I believe in everything I've said during my lifetime. My death will be my final testimony to them that it's the truth. A man has nothing more precious than his life, and when I willingly give mine for the thing I believe in, it will make people stop and think." Shortly after his speech, Joseph willingly offers himself to protect his cellmates. "I am the man you want, not these others. Here I am. Shoot me." But while Nalder's play reflects a recognition of the trope of Christian martyrdom by painting Joseph as selflessly accepting death, it does violence to what actually happened. After ordering the destruction of the Nauvoo expositor, Joseph was charged with inciting a riot. A writ of habeas corpus issued by the Municipal Court of Nauvoo made it fortuitously possible for the case against him to be dismissed by a Mormon judge. According to John Taylor, the public was outraged and interpreted Joseph's actions as a refusal to submit to law. Although Joseph appeared before non-Mormon Esquire Wells, who again dismissed the case, the damage was already done. Joseph's actions were interpreted as those of a dictator, one who under the titles of prophet, mayor, and lieutenant general consolidated all power to himself, both temporal and legal, military, and spiritual. And thus, people perceived him as occupying a position of legal immunity. On June 18, 9 days before his death, Joseph declared martial law in Nauvoo, for which he would later be charged with treason. People were gathering to come and get him in the Mormons, okay, in reaction to the charges being dropped against him, dismissed. At this time, he addressed the Nauvoo Legion, asking for commitment from the Legion to stand by him to the death. Quote, "Drawing his sword and presenting it to heaven, he said, I call God and angels to witness that I have unsheathed my sword with a firm and unalterable determination that this people shall have their legal rights." He also pledged that, quote, "While I live, I will never tamely submit to the dominion of cursed mobocracy." Although antithetical to the tradition of martyrdom, no truer words were ever spoken. Joseph Smith then vowed war and prophesied divine vengeance. "If there is one drop of bloodshed on this occasion, the sword shall never be sheathed until Christ comes to reign on earth." Then, in a rhetorically complex gesture, Joseph stated that, "I am ready to be offered a sacrifice for this people, and that I am willing to sacrifice my life for your preservation." It appears, however, that Joseph did everything in his power to avoid death. On June 20th, he addressed a letter to John Tyler, President of the United States, asking for help. The same day, Joseph recalled the 10 apostles, who, among other things, were back east publicizing Joseph's candidacy for President of the United States. He also directed Theodore Turley to commence the manufacture of artillery. In preparation of a siege, he instructed saints to bring provisions such as wheat to store in Nauvoo, and he urged Hiram to leave on a steamboat for Cincinnati. Joseph's motives for sending Hiram away challenged the trope of martyrdom, complexly encompassing both his desire to protect Hiram as well as preparations to ensure vengeance. Quote, "I said to the company present, I wish I could get Hiram out of the way so that he may live to avenge my blood, and I will stay with you and see it out." Hiram refused to flee. No martyr in the history of martyrdom, however, attempted to arrange events as Joseph did so that a family member, or anyone else for that matter, could punish the persecutors. On June 22nd, however, Joseph reiterates his desire, lamenting that, "I want Hiram to live to avenge my blood, but he is determined not to leave me." Later that night, Joseph and Hiram fled Nauvoo, crossing the Mississippi River in a leaky boat at 2 a.m. Merely 12 hours later, upon learning that Governor Ford promised protection, Joseph decided to give himself up, writing, I now offer to come to you at Carthage on the morrow, provided we can have a fair trial, not be abused by, nor have my witnesses abused, and have all things done in due form of law. Joseph returned to Nauvoo and spent the evening of the 23rd at home. The next morning he started for Carthage, stopping to sign an order by Governor Ford which ordered the Nauvoo Legion to return state arms. He spent Monday evening 4 miles outside of Carthage, and on Tuesday, Joseph and Hiram surrendered themselves to Constable Bettisworth. They were placed under arrest on charges of treason. Once imprisoned, Joseph continued to try to protect himself, doing everything short of calling out the Nauvoo Legion. Perhaps he ruled out this option because he was imprisoned on charges for treason for calling the Legion out in the first place. Or quite possibly, Joseph felt that he could receive a fair trial and protection by the law. That morning, for example, he addressed a letter to Lawyer Browning requesting his assistance for arraignment on treason on Saturday. Afterwards, Governor Ford presented Generals Joseph and Hiram Smith to the state militia. That afternoon, Joseph felt confident that Governor Ford would protect him. Writing to Emma, he states, "There was a little mutiny among the Carthage Greys, but I think the governor has and will succeed in enforcing the laws." Later that day, Joseph met again with Governor Ford, who was preparing to travel to Nauvoo, and requested to accompany him. In an addendum to the letter to Emma, Joseph reported that he would soon be released on bail. But while bail was granted for charges against Joseph for causing the riot, he was held in prison for the charges of treason. Joseph's concern for his safety grew. The next day, June 26, Joseph met with Governor Ford again and requested to accompany him, saying, "I do not consider myself safe here." But the day he would die, Joseph learned that Governor Ford had returned to Nauvoo without taking him and Joseph along. According to John Taylor, this caused very unpleasant feelings as we were apprised that we were left at the tender mercies of the Carthage Greys, a company strictly mobocratic and whom we knew to be our most deadly enemies. Perhaps because of their vulnerable position, the group's spirits were generally dull and heavy, and thus they sent for some wine to cheer themselves up. Taylor pointedly states that the wine served no sacramental purpose, as some have believed. After drinking, he says, "We all of us felt unusually dulled and languid, with a remarkable depression of spirits." Now at the request of Hiram, John Taylor sang "The Poor Wayfaring Man of Grief," which was very much in accordance with our feelings at the time, for our spirits were all depressed. Although Spencer W. Kimball asserts that in the final hours of the life of the martyr comes a calm serenity that baffles all human explanations. On Thursday, June 27th, serenity never came to Joseph, Hiram, John Taylor, or Willard Richards. Now came the rush of the mob, firing bullets up the stairs. All four men reached for the weapons at hand, John Taylor and Willard Richards for walking sticks, Hiram Smith for a single-barrel pistol, and Joseph Smith for a six-shooter. According to history of the church, Hiram shot his weapon toward the closed door before being wounded. Hiram was retreating back, this is a quote, in front of the door and snapped his pistol when a ball struck him in the left side of his nose, and he fell on his back on the floor saying, "I am a dead man." According to John Taylor, Joseph leaned over his brother as he died saying, "Oh, my poor dear brother Hiram." Joseph then, quote, instantly arose and with a firm, quick step and a determined expression of countenance, approached the door, opened the door slightly, and snapped the pistol six successive times. Three of the shots misfired. All three of the bullets that did discharge, however, hit a man, resulting in two deaths. One might interpret Joseph's reactions as self-preservatory, as well as a fulfillment of his own desire for vengeance, or, quite possibly, a combination of both. Noting that Joseph was lieutenant general of a force of 3,000 to 4,000 men who were but 18 miles from Carthage, B.H. Roberts ironically suggests that, quote, no self-surrender, with every means for successful resistance, could have been more complete. Roberts seems to admire Joseph's retaliations as well as his success at avenging Hiram. Quote, he stood for one splendid moment as some avenging spirit returning the fire of the mob. Although Roberts argues that Joseph does indeed merit the title of martyr, never in the history of martyrdom has a martyr been described as an avenging spirit. Offering resistance constitutes an uncomfortable challenge to Joseph's martyrdom. In fact, resistance by a Christian martyr, not to mention the infliction of death on the persecutors, is unheard of in the Bible, Acts of the Christian Martyrs, John Fox's Book of Martyrs, and the Book of Mormon. Spencer W. Kimball's The Pattern of Martyrdom also requires that the individual voluntarily embrace death. But Kimball refuses to address the issue of Joseph's resistance, asserting that, quote, "The martyrdom of Joseph Smith, like that of the martyrs before him, is another of the infallible proofs of the divinity of the gospel of Jesus Christ, restored to its fullness through the humble prophet." After exhausting his ammunition, Joseph stepped to the side of the door, encouraging Taylor and Richards to continue their defense as they hit the gun muzzles out of the way with their walking sticks. After a while, John Taylor tried to leap the window, quote, "Seeing no hope of escape or protection, as we were now unarmed, it occurred to me that we might have some friends outside and that there might be some chance of escape." He was wounded in the attempt. Shortly after Taylor's attempt, Joseph himself tried to leap the window. Apparently, with the wounding of three men, the mob was reticent to enter the room and instead were reaching their pistols and weapons around, trying to fire blindly, according to Willard Richards. While Taylor admits that he had attempted to leap the window to escape, nearly all LDS writers follow in the tradition of Daniels, who dismisses escape as a motivation for Joseph's leap, attributing it instead to an altruistic desire to save the lives of the others. Willard Richards finds no reason, however, to attribute Joseph's attempt to any altruistic motive, simply calling it a last resort. At the window with Joseph, Willard Richards recalls that, "As his feet went out of the window, my head went in, the balls whistling all around." Richards then, quote, "withdrew from the window, thinking it of no use to leap out on 100 bayonets, then around General Smith's body." If Richards was at the window, as he claims to have been, and he too was leaning out, it appears that both he and Joseph were attempting to leave the room, just as Taylor had done. Now, you might ask, why is it important to assess Joseph's actions, the motivation of Joseph's actions, whether it's motivated by altruism or self-preservation? The main reason is that martyrs do not flee the scene of their own martyrdom. In the 1909 February Improvement era, James Guffin devotes an entire article, "The Prophet's Last Earthly Act," to defending Joseph's move toward the window. Were it true that Joseph's motive in rushing to the window was to save his own life, writes Duffin, the character of the man, formed by a life of devotion to eternal principles and his brethren, must in that moment be changed. Duffin concludes unsurprisingly that he did it, quote, "to save the lives of his brethren. That was the inspiration for the last mortal act of our beloved prophet." Duffin focuses on the 14-foot drop to the ground, and the mob outside is evidence that Joseph knew he would be hurt, not saved. But he fails to mention that these same circumstances did not discourage John Taylor's attempt, nor did they earn Taylor an endorsement of selflessness. Prior to falling from the window, Joseph uttered the words, "O Lord, my God." While some, such as Spencer W. Kimball, who misquotes this, by the way, and just says he said, "Oh my God," while some, such as Spencer W. Kimball, infer this to be a prayer to God, much in the tradition of martyrdom, B.H. Roberts poses the question, martyrs pray before they die. B.H. Roberts poses the question, did Joseph Smith make the Masonic appeal for help? The Masonic cry of distress begins with the same words, "O Lord, my God," and then follows up with, "Have mercy on the widow's son." It was supposed to summon any fellow member of the fraternity to the aid of his brother. If Joseph were attempting the Masonic cry of distress, this would also indicate that he tried to avoid death until the last moments. While B.H. Roberts, quote, can form no adequate or positive opinion as to whether Joseph indeed made the appeal, he quotes a passage from the July 15... Are we at time?
1 minute.
1 minute. Okay, I need three here. 1844, Times and Seasons, which seems to endorse the idea that Joseph died while attempting to enlist the help of his fellow Masons. According to Roberts, the editorial was most likely written by John Taylor, W.W. Phelps, or Willard Richards, and may have been the result of consultation among all three. Referring to Joseph and Hiram by their Masonic degree, Master, the editorial scolds Masons for not coming to Joseph's aid, quote, "They were both Masons in good standing, ye brethren of the mystic tie, what think ye? Where is our good master Joseph and Hiram? Joseph's last exclamation was, O Lord, my God." Because of Joseph's actions prior to death, because they don't conform to the tradition of martyrdom, B.H. Roberts redefines martyrdom, insisting that there is, however, another and equally as true a conception of martyrdom, and that is wherein the persistence in and the maintenance of a cause, one suffers toil and danger and finally death because of adherence to this cause, though using all the means that prudence would suggest to avoid both danger and death. The requirements of martyrdom suggested by B.H. Roberts form a uniquely Mormon appropriation, a complete redefinition of the traditional Christian ideal. Herbert Musurillo notes that the earliest collection of the Acts of the Martyrs served an edifying and apologetic purpose. It is likely that the death of Joseph Smith will continue to serve as an edifying and apologetic aspect of Mormonism. But in the sesquicentennial of his assassination, fidelity to the facts serves to focus the story in a new light as Mormonism grapples with its past. It's time to let Joseph's actions speak for themselves without excusing or deleting those which seem distasteful or contradict his status as a traditional Christian martyr. Just as Latter-day Saints will continue to sing praise to his memory, he died as a martyr, the status of Joseph Smith as a martyr should continue to receive critical reexamination as we remember that on June 27, 1844, died Lieutenant General Joseph Smith, commander of the Nauvoo Legion, mayor of the city, candidate for the President of the United States. Thank you.
Thank you, Warren. Now to respond to that very, very learned discourse, we have somebody who's equally capable in scholarly aspects and our resident theologian from Katok, Mr. Van Hale.
I don't know about being associated with a talk station has any credibility, but this being the 150th anniversary of the deaths of Joseph and Hiram, I appreciate Warren Parkins drawing our attention to the details and implications of that tragic event. In my response, I will confine my comments to three areas: definition of the term martyr, emphasis and portrayal, and assessment of references in church publications. Parkins states, "I intend to explicate the radical redefinition of martyrdom required to label Joseph Smith a martyr. Pairing of significant details which contradict the pattern of martyrdom will also receive attention as this study endeavors to illuminate the uniquely Mormon appropriation of the Christian ideal of martyrdom." He proceeds to develop a definition of martyr which requires a non-resistance, willing, joyful death in which the martyr must express an attitude of concern for the well-being of his killers and must absolve them of any responsibility, harboring no desire for their wrong to be avenged. Also, the martyrdom must be an unjust death. I believe Parkins' definition is significantly flawed. If he were asserting that this is his definition and that by it Joseph Smith cannot be defined as a martyr, then there would be no dispute. However, he presents his definition as the only legitimate one. I have quickly collected eight definitions, two from standard dictionaries, Webster's 1828 dictionary and the American Heritage Dictionary, and from six dictionaries of Christian history. All differ substantially from Parkins' definition. The Webster 1828 dictionary defines martyr as one who by death bears witness to the truth of the gospel. Second definition, one who suffers death in defense of a cause. The American Heritage Dictionary 1969 defines martyr as one who chooses to suffer death rather than renounce religious principles. Definition two, someone who sacrifices something very important to him in order to further a belief, cause, or principle. And three, a person who endures great suffering. The Westminster Dictionary of Christian History, 1971, defines martyr in this way, at least in part, a word meaning witness, which initially referred to those who had witnessed the historic events of Jesus' ministry. Later it designated those by who by their sufferings had witnessed to their faith in him. It came finally to be used only of those who had died under persecution, thereby witnessing supremely. Those who had been faithful under persecution but who had survived were called confessors. The martyrs soon became venerated as intercessors. Their bones and relics were used to sanctify places of worship, and the use of relics for devotional purposes was sometimes carried out to surprising lengths. The Encyclopedia of Early of the Early Church, recently published in 1992 by Oxford University Press, states that martyrdom received a spiritual interpretation, particularly in monastic circles. Any physical or mental suffering of a believer was considered a martyrdom. Also acknowledged is the fact that in some accounts of martyrdom, we even find offensive words against the persecutors. A practice of certain Christians avid to show the greatness of their faith and attain the heavenly rewards manifested an excessive desire for death. This is denounced in this particular encyclopedia. The Schaff-Herzog Religious Encyclopedia reports that in the early centuries, Christians were expressly forbidden to seek martyrdom, and further states, the evangelical church canonizes no martyrs and believes it to be as great a thing to live for Christ as to die for him, but it too cherishes the examples of those who have been, in the literal sense, faithful unto death. It is therefore true that there are definitions from sources at least as authoritative as Parkin, which define many as martyrs whom Parkin would not. A further problem with his definition is that it may be difficult to label Jesus a martyr by his standard. Jesus, in a prayer offered several times and recorded in the Synoptic Gospels, asked that God remove the bitter cup being his impending suffering and death. Jesus was seeking some possible alternative, and there is nothing joyful in the tone of his prayer. While he asked God to forgive the Roman guards who were crucifying him, they were only fulfilling their duty and were not the ones seeking Jesus' death. Also, the Gospels contain many of Jesus' harsh denunciations of his enemies, as well as graphic descriptions of their fate, where their worm dieth not and their fire is not quenched. At Nazareth, the people sought to kill him, but Jesus escaped from their midst. Concerning these aspects of the gospel accounts, by Parkin's definition, we may not be able to consider Jesus a martyr. And yet I believe if the question were asked, who was the greatest Christian martyr, Jesus would be by far the most frequent reply. Parkin asserts that Mormons have completely redefined the term. However, his definition may in fact be the radical redefinition. In looking at the emphasis and portrayal of the historical events by Warren Parkin, I take issue with his emphasis and portrayal as he deals with the historical sources. He concludes, in the sesquicentennial Joseph Smith's assassination, fidelity to the facts serves to focus the story in a new light as Mormonism grapples with its past. It's time to let Joseph's actions speak for themselves without excusing those which seem distasteful, or in the case of Joseph's death, those which contradict his status as a traditional martyr. I realize that each individual approaches historical sources from a different perspective, resulting in differing opinions as to what sources and events deserve more emphasis, the result of which can be legitimate portrayals of history which are substantially at odds. Working from the same sources, one account can sound very different from another. Having said this, I do, however, feel that Parkin has stepped out of bounds. I would like to supply a few well-known facts which are absolutely pertinent to his thesis, which Parkin either slights, distorts, or ignores altogether. By June 27, 1844, Joseph Smith had endured at least 14 years of substantial trials, privations, and persecutions. He had faced almost certain death on several occasions and had lived under a very real threat of death for most of those years. He had faced mobs, experienced serious physical, emotional, financial, and family problems. He had done this willingly, never deserting the cause he had espoused. According to one standard definition of martyr, Joseph Smith was a martyr before his death. I briefly refer to several events leading to Joseph's final ordeal. On June 22nd, Governor Ford was calling for Joseph Smith and others involved to stand trial at Carthage concerning the destruction of the Nauvoo Expositor Press. Joseph Smith replied in a letter, quote, "We would not hesitate to stand another trial according to your excellency's wish, were it not that we are confident our lives would be in danger. We dare not come. Writs, we are assured, are issued against us in various parts of the country. For what? To drag us from place to place, from court to court, across the creeks and prairies, till some bloodthirsty villain can find his opportunity to shoot us. We dare not come, though your excellency promises protection. Yet at the same time you have expressed fears that you could not control the mob, in which case we are left to the mercy of the merciless. Sir, we dare not come, for our lives would be in danger. Sir, you must not blame us, for a burnt child dreads the fire. Leaving his life in safety and the safety of Nauvoo to be in grave danger, Joseph Smith crossed the river and was going to start west to make preparations to move the Saints to the west, a plan which had been developing for several years. The feelings of some at Nauvoo that he was deserting them at a time of great need, or that he was a coward, resulted in his return to Nauvoo with a determination to go to Carthage in spite of the fact that he strongly believed that he would not return alive. One of Joseph Smith's final statements as he left Nauvoo for Carthage was reported in the July 15, 1844 issue of the Times and Seasons. It's one of the most widely quoted statements referring to this event. He says, "I am going like a lamb to the slaughter, but I am calm as a summer's morning. I have a conscience void of offense toward God and toward all men. I shall die innocent." A number of saints reported similar statements which he made to them as he was leaving Nauvoo for Carthage. He traveled to Carthage, where he submitted to arrest and was killed by the mob estimated at about 200, part of whom rushed up the stairs of the jail, firing through the door, while others of the mob fired from the ground outside through the window. As Parkin has described, after Hiram was shot and killed, Joseph fired three shots into the mob before he was killed. Parkin's portrayal is that of a gun battle, a quote, gun battle, with Joseph, quote, pistol blazing, quote, wreaking carnage. To me, Parkin has stepped out of bounds. Parkin doesn't grant Joseph much slack. When Smith said, "That's right, Brother Taylor, parry them off as well as you can," Parkin interprets this as a desperate and, from the context, uncharitable desire for self-preservation, vengeance, and utter disregard for the welfare of persecutors. If we look closely at the spontaneous utterance of the prophet, and then at Parkin's expansive and unfair summary of it, we realize that his judgmental conclusion may not depend on evidence. He has failed to bring pertinent information to his discussion, which is found in many of the sources he partially quotes, and then on the slimmest of technicalities. Yes, there were shots fired from both sides, so I guess you could say there was technically a battle. He paints a picture distorted almost beyond recognition. Substantial historical sources force me to answer. Did Joseph Smith have to go to Carthage? No. Did he believe that he would die in Carthage? Yes. Did he seek death? No. Did he hope he would escape death? Yes. Did he go to Carthage willingly anyway? Yes. Did he give his life for the saints and the cause? Yes. Was he a martyr? Let me turn finally to an assessment of the references in church publications to which Parkin makes reference. His primary interest seems to be Joseph's firing the pistol into the mob who had just killed his brother Hiram. In his research, Parkin has discovered that many references in church publications do not mention Joseph with the gun. He implies that this is the result of a church cover-up to save Joseph's title of martyr. Quote, "One might interpret the omission of certain details so prevalent in accounts meant for wide consumption by believers and potential converts as attempts to make the death of Joseph conform to the tradition of martyrdom." He states that Joseph's retaliation poses problems, finds witness in the silence it receives. And he further asserts that omitting Joseph's marksmanship has become a Mormon tradition. He sees the fact that a June 1994 article in the Ensign includes the gun incident as a possible, quote, "shift in church policy, opening the door for grappling with the whole story surrounding Joseph's death instead of exclusively focusing on aspects which fall into the traditional pattern of martyrdom and thereby seemingly testify of Joseph's divine calling." Since it was my impression that the account of the gun has been frequently retold throughout the history of the church, I decided to make a quick random check of church publications. In half a day in the church library, I found hundreds of references to the martyrdom throughout all kinds of church publications. There are many which give the account of the gun and many which do not. However, I am forced to reject Parkin's assertions. Throughout the entire history of the church since 1844, there are numerous references to the gun in sermons, church magazines, the church news, Relief Society, Sunday school, priesthood, and other manuals. While my quick survey is not comprehensive, my random sampling was sufficient to lead me to the observation that when brief mention is made of the martyrdom, it typically does not include the gun. But when the purpose is to retell the account of Joseph's death, the gun is included regardless of the intended audience. Just to mention a few which include the gun, the history of the church in print since 1911, B.H. Roberts' comprehensive history in print since 1930, these are all church publications, the story of the Latter-day Saints, a work of the historical department for wide distribution among members in print since 1976, the Mormon Experience, written by church historian and assistant church historian for wide distribution among members and non-members, a number of articles in the Improvement Era and its successor, The Ensign, the current Gospel Doctrine Manual on the Doctrine and Covenants in Church History, a number of articles in the Church News, including one in 1990 about an artifacts exhibit opening in the Church Museum, a high-traffic church tourist and information center with artifacts from Carthage, including a pistol identified as the one Joseph fired into the mob. I even found an article in the Instructor of 1968 entitled "It Happened at Carthage." It is a flannel board presentation for some of the young Sunday school classes on the martyrdom. In scene 5 is the prophet with, quote, a revolver which one of the brethren had managed to bring him. Opening the door a couple of inches, he discharged the six-shooter, but some barrels misfired. His assertion of a church policy of deleting the gun from martyrdom accounts in church publications fails upon examination. In conclusion, let us come to the center of Parkin's argument. It is not, he presents no new evidence. It is simply a challenge to the legitimacy of applying the term martyr to the murdered Smiths. For Parkin, one cannot be a martyr except by inviting the death, accepting it willingly, and expressing love and goodwill towards the murderers. That may be his definition. It may even be the definition of the Catholic Church, which has procedures for determining who is a saint. But we are not dealing with a legal procedure, with a term that has several meanings. If Joseph Smith fits any of these definitions, he was a martyr. Was he a witness, the root meaning of the term? I think so. Did he suffer for his faith? I think so. Parkin may not like that faith and may not think Joseph Smith's witness credible, but that is not the point. One can be a martyr for the Branch Davidians or, for that matter, to the Mafia. One does not even have to suffer death to be a martyr, only suffering. But did Joseph Smith suffer death? And was this for his religion? Again, I think so. Did he suffer death willingly? And again, I think so. Mr. Parkin may not like the religion and may justify the feelings of the anti-Mormons. He may even wish to justify the extra-legal and cowardly murder of the two prisoners whose safety had been guaranteed by the governor of the state. But this is not the point. Smith did suffer death, and this for his convictions. In short, according to the standard definitions of the term, Joseph Smith and his brother Hiram died as martyrs. It may be of interest that immediately after the event at Carthage, an intelligent non-Mormon, Horace Greeley, could recognize an obvious fact. The lynching of Joseph and Hiram Smith created martyrs. The fact that the Latter-day Saints have continued to so regard them is proof that Greeley was right. Incidentally, Joseph Smith's last words were not as Parkin tells them. His final words as he fell from the window were, "O Lord, my God."
Thank you. At this time, official timekeeper, Alice, how many?
9 minutes.
9 minutes. We have 9 minutes for your questions at this time. Let me repeat that question before the cassette. Okay, you're going to do it?
The question is am I equally as skeptical of the presentations of the traditional martyrs that I quote from, finding that one story or parts of the story have been told? Sure I am. I'm calling that a tradition. A tradition that was started in the New Testament, and that throughout, although in the response it was asserted that martyrs try to throw themselves at death, this has been disparaged and rejected as martyrdom throughout the history. So I don't think Joseph should have thrown himself, tried to die. That's not a part of the definition. And it is, I would reiterate, rejected throughout Christian history. But I don't think, as you pointed out, just in all Lives of the Saints story and all hagiographic writings, we have them today in our Mormon culture through the biographies of anybody who's important, especially anybody who ascends to the mantle of prophet. There are patterns to these stories, structural, predictable patterns. What that means to me is that there are certain ways that are accepted as perceiving things, and they gloss over, distort, refocus, so that they can fit that pattern. So, yes, I would say that I agree with that. The observation is that in the church's video, reference to the gun is conspicuously absent. Mr. Hell asserts that I am only trying to find church publications. I'm saying that the church has never mentioned the presence of a weapon. That was not my assertion in the paper. I assert that on occasion it is mentioned. I don't quibble with that. What is never mentioned, or rarely, I better be certain since I don't have access to every source in the world, is the result of him shooting at the crowd itself. So we have people held up who've been killed. It was an act of self-defense, the way I look at it. And I'm not faulting Joseph for responding that way. My purpose, entire purpose, is to, and I think we've, sharp contrast has been drawn, that there is a uniquely different appropriation of this term in our Mormon culture. So, reiterating once again, the firing of the weapon and the result of that firing is also conspicuously absent in most church accounts.
It may be that a person could be a member of the church for some time and not have the knowledge of the fact that there was a gun in Joseph Smith's hand in Carthage jail. But in order for that to be the case, it would require not having heard or paid attention to the gospel doctrine lessons of the last decade in which that is clearly presented, not having read the history of the church on that point, not having read numerous Ensign articles on that point, not having looked at the church news on that, where that point is brought out. One of the articles that I referred to in my paper is this one from the church news, 1990. There's a picture of the revolver that Joseph Smith had, and telling about how this is part of the church museum display. I think if a person is not aware of the fact that there was a gun in Joseph Smith's hand in the Carthage jail, I'm kind of at a loss as to how to explain that, because it's in, as I mentioned, it's taught to the youth in some of the manuals that the youth are using. In this particular article in the Church News of 1990, it says, more familiar objects to be included are the pistols of the prophet and patriarch. So the author of this article, Glenn Leonard, director of the Museum of Church History and Art, is saying that one of the more familiar objects to be included are the pistols of the prophet and patriarch. So of the artifacts, I think it is, at least in my estimation, it is very well established through many, many sources that Joseph Smith and Hiram had a gun and that Joseph Smith fired it.
In the education that you refer to, Mr. Hale, are we reminded of the people or the firing of the shot and the consequences of the shots he fired? Are we educated regarding this fact?
Well, there is some difference in the accounts about what happened on the firing of the shots. There are accounts that suggest that there were some people who were killed. However, the best investigation on this appears to me to be the work of of Dallin Oaks and Marvin Hill and Carthage conspiracy, in which they identify the three individuals, and nobody died from wounds suffered from Joseph Smith's firing of the gun. But does that answer your question?
I'd like to add to that that this would be an element of vengeance which is highlighted in Mormon history and which I try to bring in with the Book of Mormon, that persecutors are punished. The fate of the persecutors of the prophet Joseph Smith is an excellent example of page after page of people who mess with the Lord or the Lord's prophet are in for a lot of trouble.
Think word about that time. I've been the recipient of the last while, since we've had visitors here from out of town, of seeing legacy and seeing a few other things. And I sometimes wonder personally if correlation sometimes doesn't get into the way of history. But as Van Hale has so eloquently pointed out to me, I now have more impetus to read, to study, and to digest. Thank you very much for your attendance here.
Appreciate your response.
Salamanca, the French club. So I enjoyed your time.